May it please the Court, my name is Paula Say Duper. I'm an attorney from Billings, Montana, appearing on behalf of the defendant, Jack Glendale Stanley, along with my co-counsel and mentor, Rob Stevens. We are here today, Your Honors, to request that you reverse the decision of the verdict of the Billings Court and jury in this case because Mr. Stanley was denied his right to cross-examine a dead informant. And as a result, we feel that his case was compromised because testimony was allowed in through tape recordings, also through the testimony of the agents on the stand, which were clarifying to the jury statements made by the confidential informant.
Well, the tape recording, tapes have been held admissible, right, under our jurisprudence.
The court did admit the tapes.
Yes,
we feel that, based on the Crawford decision, Your Honor, that the tapes portions of those tapes constituted testimonial evidence.
Okay, what in the testimony of that comes through the tapes are you objecting to? You're not objecting to the statements by Mr. Stanley, I take it, since those would be admissions, would they not be?
I have to agree with the Court that those are admissions of Mr. Stanley. However, I think taken in the context of Mr. Thurrell, who was the confidential informant, I don't think that the tape should have been admitted.
Well, how were these presented to the jury, that they should take the information from the informant as offered for the truth, or what were they offered to?
I could give you some examples, Your Honor. Their transcript is replete, but I do have a few page notations for you to refer to. And on page 93, that the agent is testifying that Mr. Stanley, or that the confidential informant told them that Jack Stanley was one of the people.
You're reading from 93 of the
transcript, Your Honor.
But what in the tape? The tape was played.
So your question is with regard to the tapes.
I'd like to sort the tape out first.
Okay.
In other words, the tape was played to the jury, correct?
The tapes were played to the jury. They were also given transcripts that
right.
had been
told
prepared
told that
by
the tape was the better evidence.
Correct.
Okay, so now, and Mr. Stanley's heard on the tape, and you said that that's admission, that's not hearsay. So the confrontation comes as to whether or not the testimony that came through the tape is hearsay in the first instance, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so why is it hearsay? What was it offered for?
It was offered for, there were several of those statements that were offered for the truth, Your Honor.
Okay.
For instance.
And you were going to give me an example from
exactly.
the tape, what was offered for the truth.
In one of the instances, Mr. Thurrell is back in the car with the government agent, and he says that Mr. Stanley has gone to get the pills. He also makes another statement. The agent is asking him, did you give him the money? No, he went to get the pills. That is on the tape. And that was, then the jury was allowed to hear that. We believe that that falls under the testimonial portion, as well as various other statements that were made in the tape transcripts.
One example, just to pursue it to get a flavor for how this came in, was there any limiting instruction to the jury on what they should, how they should treat the statements of the confidential informant?
Not to my recollection.
So there's no limitation that says that they should disregard or not take into account the statement he went to get the pills?
Not to my recollection.
Can you tell me where that is?
That portion would be on page, I have it on page 96, but that, I don't have the tape transcript.
I have the transcript,
Your Honor. I believe it would have had to do with the February 6th transaction, and the tape transcripts are in the government's
This is the transcript of what was going on in court.
Correct.
Okay.
Your Honor, while you're reading, I forgot to announce that my co-counsel will be doing part of this argument. We will be reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal. We would be asking you to look at the U.S. v. Cromer, which is a Sixth Circuit case, in making your decision here today, and use the three-part constitutional confrontation clause analysis that was adopted in Cromer to help you identify certain of these conversations that are on the tape as testimonial and that they should not have been allowed.
Were these objected to at the time?
Yes, there was a continued. We had a Your Honor, we had filed a motion.
I know there was a lot of dispute about it.
Yes.
At the time of the tape, was there an objection?
Yes, there was an objection, I believe, at the beginning of every tape. We had
That's fine. That was
objections
my understanding.
Throughout.
Okay.
I think that the government's brief to this court is there is a misstatement where he says that we did not object to the validity, the audibility of the tapes or the validity of them, and in fact, at page 40 of the transcript, we did make that objection. They use that as one of their arguments of why we should not be allowed to keep the tapes out. We had objected to that. There were a lot of unintelligible portions on those tapes, which made it very hard to understand what was going on. The transcripts that the government had prepared had been altered by the government agents after they had been prepared by another off-site company, and those things were objected to as well.
Okay. Let me understand. This is on page 96. Is this the witness explaining what is on the tapes?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, okay.
And that occurs on several occasions. Mr. Bertain is on the stand. He's narrating what is going on in those tapes and what is being told to him by the confidential informant.
He was standing there for a few minutes. Mr. Stanley left, so I waved him over and I asked him, did you give him the money? He said no. Then there's objection, overruled. The witness said no, that Mr. Stanley had gone to that Mr. Stanley had gone to pick up the bills.
Exactly. I think that the statements that have been made by the confidential informant throughout are implicating Mr. Stanley in criminal activity. Under the Cromer test, Mr. Thorell certainly knew that his position, that his statements would be used against Mr. Stanley if charges were in fact filed, and they were. And I think we can establish that a lot of those statements were offered for their truth and that it is a violation of the Confrontation Clause and it does amount to plain error and there should be a reversal.
Okay.
Thank you. I will now turn this over to my partner, Mr. Stevens, who's going to argue issues 2 and 3 for you.
Right. Thank you.
Please the Court. Rob Stevens joining on behalf of Jack Stanley. What time do we have left at this point?
You have about 9.
I'll try and be very brief then. The judge ruled, the Article III judge in that trial ruled that the issue of credibility of the deceased informant was irrelevant. He stated in the context of that ruling that there was no reason why we would want to challenge the credibility of the informant, because the tape recordings were there and they accurately portrayed the transactions. It demonstrated a fundamental problem with our second argument, because if, in fact, the testimony of the confidential informant, not only as recorded in an exchange between Jack Stanley, but also in exchanges with the agents on the tape, are non-testimonial in nature, but by definition, the right to cross-examination is an absurd irrelevancy because cross-examination is intended to test the reliability of testimony. One of the critical aspects on the issues that arose at trial was that we knew that the confidential informant had made importunities to Jack. I'm dying. I can't afford money for a transplant. I can't get a prescription for OxyContin. We gave notice that we were going to seek an entrapment defense. Agent Britton was able to describe for the jury a characterization where there is a generic description of money owed by the confidential informant of Jack Stanley, $40. Well, Agent Britton, what was that for? That was a drug transaction, an earlier drug transaction. That was, how do you know that, Agent Britton? Because the confidential informant told me that's clearly testimonial in nature. The entire transaction being recorded are testimonial in nature. This is my last CJA case that I tried in district court. Judge in this case found that Stevens could not follow the rules and couldn't take no for an answer. The judge was partially correct. I tried over and over to get in this impeachment material because of the entrapment defense and because of the nature of the cooperating arrangement. I didn't know that judges could take away your status as a CJA panel member. Had I known that, it may have impacted negatively my zeal in this case. Contrary to the government's position, we made every appropriate recommendation or objection. We made three pretrial motions. We objected to the reliability of the tapes. We objected to the entire process of chain of evidence. Chain of evidence could not be established without reliance upon hearsay. It's a fundamental element of proof. They had to rely upon what the informant was saying. He was an addict. He had sources other than what he was purporting to get from Jack Stanley. He OD'd and died from OxyContin. He was never signed up by the DEA. He had a special arrangement to compromise or keep him out of prison on state pending charges on multiple forgeries, all of which were irrelevant to his credibility.
If we were to consider only the admissions that were made by your client himself and just excise basically everything that the confidential informant said separately, wouldn't the jury have come to the same conclusion because his statements were self-incriminatory?
Well, we don't know because we were never able to develop the entrapment defense because of the limitations on cross-examination and the ruling of the district judge that the credibility of the informant was irrelevant.
Well, I guess my question is kind of a harmless error question. In view of his admissions, even if the jury had said, well, this other guy's just kind of a lying sleaze, but here he is admitting all this stuff anyway, so what difference does it make?
I think you apply a plain error analysis. The cross-examination issue is a backup so that if you choose to apply a harmless error analysis, I don't think that is valid because of the impact on the defense that was being urged by the defendant for the jury. It's similar to those cases that are cited in our brief where the defendant is saying somebody else did it. Well, that isn't exactly what we were doing, but we were saying if we did it, it was excused.
So just so I understand, what you're arguing is that the agent was allowed to tape and the agent were allowed to put before the jury the elements of this transaction. Some of the, as your co-counsel indicated, some of the statements were, in fact, incriminatory on their face by saying he went to get the pills. Okay, so your argument is that with respect to, first of all, that was hearsay for Britton to state it. And then you're saying as insofar as impeaching the source of the original source of the statement, the deceased, the dead confidential informant, that you wanted to show that separate and apart and outside what you could pick up from the tape or from any testimony about it, that he did things, said things that were entrapping of Stanley to get him to go through with this transaction. And if you could have impeached the informant's credibility, what? How would that have proved the entrapment? That's what I'm not sure.
Well, counsel, situations, the confidential informant was having conversations and contacts with Mr. Stanley that were not monitored and not recorded. Second of all, Agent Britton was able to testify about predisposition testimony based solely upon
what... I understand, but that, what is it about the informant's credibility that's going to figure into this mix? You may have a problem with what the agent has been allowed to testify to. The question I'm trying to address is, where's the error, where's the linkage on the entrapment theory by not allowing you to impeach the credibility of the informant?
We felt that we could show that the informant had a strong motivation to fabricate, and we could also elicit from the informant the special consideration that he received from state prosecutors to keep him out of jail if he would get Stanley. Now, this was a target operation and a recruitment, contrary to the assertion of the government, a recruitment of an unacceptable informant under DEA standards in order to target a specific individual. And the history of that, I think, was developed very limited in the court below. But that is the issue of entrapment.
Okay.
Obviously, that was not adequately clarifying. I believe that the oxycodone quantity issue is adequately briefed and does not need to be addressed orally.
Is that is that affected by Blakely?
It is, I think.
Well, the government seems to think it is.
Yes, and I wouldn't disagree with that because it was a consideration of penalty enhancement without a jury determination. Okay. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jim Sikora. I'm an assistant United States attorney. I was given this case a few days before trial. I was trial counsel, and I'm still counsel. Your Honors, you've hit the nail on the head. After Crawford, this was a pre-Crawford case, but after Crawford, I think all discussions began whether it's testimonial or non-testimonial. The motion that was made by the defendant prior to trial was that tapes themselves were absolutely inadmissible for various reasons, including the dead man statute and other things. Judge Siebel in the lower court looked at it, said, citing the appropriate cases, saying there's a guarantee of trustworthiness here. We're going to take a look at it. At trial, the United States, through the agent, established that the tapes were monitored by him and other agents. They were done through the informant. Over 30 phone calls were provided in addition to body wires of the meets. During those meets with the defendant, they had eyeballs on the guy, not all the time. But getting to the point very quickly, Your Honor, to answer your last question, interrupting my argument about the issue, may have a problem with what the agent said on the stand as opposed to the tapes. Right in the tapes, Mr. Stanley is heard saying, I'm going over to my house. And before the judge and the jury, we ask that we skip ahead 6 minutes of the tape rather than listen to 6 minutes of silence. And there's an explanation that they saw him leave the parking lot and come back. And within the context of when the agent said, he told me.
Well, his going to the house doesn't prove anything.
I know. It's not.
But it does if the agent's then allowed to testify that he said, and it wasn't picked up on tape, or he's commenting on why he's going. He's going to get the pills.
And the defendant did that. He said, I'm going, and I'm coming back. And that's when they
exchanged. He didn't say, I'm going to get the pills, did he?
I believe it is. I'll have to check the exact record.
Well, the quote that was referred to, the agent saying, and I'm not clear whether he said it on tape, or
And you're looking at page 95 and 96.
Yes, is that on the tape? He's saying
it's on the tape, and that's why we put it in our excerpt of record. I'll find it for you, Your Honor.
Yeah, so he is making a testimonial statement out of court about what the defendant is doing. That's a testimonial statement. That's subject to cross-examination.
That's potential.
I mean, you know, how do we know that the guy's telling the truth? Maybe he's decided to set him up. The guy's going off, whatever. I mean, that's fair game for cross, isn't it?
And I think it is, but in the grand...
And you were offering it for the truth of the matter, correct? You had to be. What's the relevance to say he's going to give
it? It was in the context.
So it was in the context of a conversation. Well, I mean, of a taped conversation. And so what did – on the tape, did he say he's gone to the house to explain?
There was reference by the – I think it's that specific. I'm leaving. I've got to go to my house. My house is over there.
Yeah.
Something affected.
And so the CI says on the tape he's gone to get the pills.
Now, and Stanley. Never, and Stanley.
Stanley said the same thing?
I'll find
– That's what I'm – I just take – since we don't have the exact words, I'm just trying to understand your position. Okay, under whether this is testimonial, non-testimonial, whether it's hearsay, non-hearsay. I'm just trying to get a bracket for this thing, because it's a little slippery after the problem. But let me just ask this. There's a conversation that leads up to Stanley saying, I'm going to my house, and he's gone for 6 minutes. Now, the inference, absent any commentary, is he's gone to get the pills, I assume, because they've been talking about OxyContin, right?
Right.
Okay, but on the tape, the informant is heard to say, arguably, let's assume for my question, that he says, okay, he's gone to go get the pills. Now he's narrating. He's not in a conversation. He's now commentating on what Stanley is presumably doing in this 6 minutes of absent silence. That is testimonial, is it not?
Arguably, it can be, but I don't believe it is, Your Honor. To establish before the jury the context of which, again, when you look at the cold transcript, you're saying the tape is played, but if you go to the continuity of all
the tape. Say to do context. Testimony is used to establish context.
And the jury had just heard Mr. Stanley say that he was leaving.
Then why did they need to put in, why can't you excise the statement about what his purpose in going to the house is?
I don't know that that was on tape, Your Honor. I think well, actually, the agent talked about it, what he told me.
In court?
Yes.
Okay, so in court now, the agent is saying, he's now testifying about what he observed? See, that's what I'm not understanding your argument. I'm trying to break this down as to what, with a dead informant who can't be cross-examined, because usually, yes, tapes come in. Yes, there's context, but there's also the informant available to be subpoenaed and brought as a witness. And then one disputes whether or not he's unavailable or not. But I'm just trying to understand, in this case, was the agent on the stand saying that's why there's a gap or that's why we're skipping ahead? He is now describing what Stanley's purpose of leaving was.
Not the purpose so much as the context that he was leaving. There's going to be a six-minute gap.
What was said on the tape after he returned?
I was going to grab the transcript, Ron, if I could do it while I'm that's when they have the exchange that takes place with the observers looking at it, and it's not until after Stanley comes back. And once again, setting this up, they had the informant wired. They had searched the car. There's surveillance. They're not able to surveil Stanley all the way over when it comes back. And then they don't lose sight of the informant when this.
Look, I just had a case where it was all on tape. It was all on tape. But what was going on inside the backseat of the car was critical. Who touched, who opened the package, who did what? Okay, so yes, it was on tape, but not the visual. It was an audio tape. So when you start having somebody filling in the surround, if you will, you now have testimony that's adding content, not just context, but content, incriminating content. And I'm trying to understand whether on this tape the CI did that by describing behavior or whether the agent's doing it as a little editorial on the stand when he's testifying, as an observant, as a percipient witness. Maybe he's okay. He's there subject to cross-examination. He's safe. I can see that he walked from his car into his house. But can he say, as a percipient witness, inside that house he got the pills? No, because he doesn't know what he got inside the house. He can testify to what he observed.
And he didn't say that he went and got the pills, right?
So that's what I'm trying to say.
And I think the tape before and the tape after bears that out, including the fact the informant never had any. The only contacts he had was with Mr. Stanley. And after Mr. Stanley had come back, the transaction occurred. You hear it on the tape, and he comes back and brings the pills to him, Your Honor.
Is this the officer, is asked, did you then have a conversation with the informant after he got out of the vehicle? Is that who's testifying? And the officer says, yes, he was standing there for a few minutes, and Mr. Stanley had left. So I waved him over and asked him, did you give him the money? And he said no. Objection, Your Honor, hearsay overruled. He said no, that Mr. Stanley had gone to pick up the pills. I said, okay, stand back over there. And so did Mr. Stanley then return 5 or 6 minutes later? It was a short time later. Yes. And the items, he got came back into the vehicle and the items were turned over to him.
And once again, the argument is to put it in the context of what was happening with the tapes. Can you read the transcript? Well,
your argument, it also sounds a little bit like, again, a harmless error argument, because whether the officer had said he went to get the pills or he didn't, the guy left, he came back, and then they exchanged pills.
And I didn't argue harmless error because I didn't. Harmless error only comes if it's improperly introduced, the tapes, in the first place.
I think that's why I was focusing on the first question.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
But getting to some of the issues that were raised regarding the there's this compendium of tapes included in there is the defendant making these admissions, whether it be an adoptive admission, he's talking about I owe $40 or not. I disagree with Mr. Stevens' suggestion that the agent was able to say that there was a former drug debt. You hear this on the tape. He goes and buys $100 worth of pills. He gives him $140. The defendant is talking about, you owe me this extra $40. Whether it's for a former drug transaction or not, that's up in the air. Yeah, I obviously owed him. It was clear from the jury and listening to the tapes that he was comfortable with meeting the informant, with talking with him, discussing these things. The other manner in which these conversations are admissible, not only Stanley, but also the informant. It's co-conspirator statements on the tape in at least three different locations. Stanley says at one time, the guy comes in, I get $100,000 at a time, and I buy him for $8 or $9 or $10. Co-conspirator statement, Stanley allying somebody to say he's selling to. There's numerous reasons in which these tapes themselves are admissible. You don't even have to go to the question beyond Crawford. The next issue that counsel talked about is once again, Britton, and talking about the various aspects of his testimony. And we argue, very frankly, and I went through it again last night looking at these, and that's why we put Britton's entire testimony in the supplemental excerpts of record, what they're argued to be and what they really aren't. On some occasions he's asked, what does D mean? It's dilated. It's an assist of the jury. It's nothing testimonial in nature that's going to rise or fall, just so that they can determine the facts. What does swabbed mean? Swabbed out. What does wired mean? Things of this nature, to aid and assist the jury.
What is your response to the defendant's argument that it was impossible to make an entrapment defense fly without having the ability to question the confidential informant?
Well, what I think of that is what Mr. Stevens admitted to this morning. Arguably, Issue 1 and 2 hangs upon what I started with, was testimonial or non-testimony. If it's non-testimonial, then there's nothing to impeach. There's nothing to put in as far as entrapment. He's entitled to call witnesses if he wishes, which he did, Deputy County Attorney, to show what kind of deals were made. I think, very frankly, Judge Siebel in the lower court, the trial court, went way beyond what he was allowed to do to show that the informant, although it was not testimonial what was put in, that he had a felony record, that he died of an overdose, that he was he died of HIV. Trying to lampoon, in essence, but since it wasn't testimony, we objected. The court, I believe, let him go further than was allowed in introduction of testimony as to the informant. But none of that should have come in, because he did not testify. It was not testimonial, Your Honor.
Well, of course he didn't testify. But let's suppose, I think the issue that we're trying to wrestle with, whether the informant testifies or not for whatever reason, if their defense is that the informant set the guy up, how are they going to prove that? You say they went too far in letting him impeach the bona fides of the informant, his character, whatever. I don't think that's before us, and I don't see what the error is under the circumstances in any event. If that's what you're trying to prove, that this guy had all sorts of motivation to, yes, get Stanley on tape, but push him into something that he wouldn't otherwise have done. Now, that's what I think the issue is. And what
he had other avenues to approach. He had other avenues to approach it as
well.
Well,
apparently he tried to do that, and the judge let him do it.
Let him do it to an extent, but he's relying solely upon the cross-examination of the agent, which was either outside the scope of the agent's knowledge, or it was other people that had it, Your Honor. And Mr. Stevens could have called those witnesses. I think I've covered issues 1 and 2. Issue 3, I think, is, if you have any questions on issue 1 and 2, the Issue three, I think, is the dicey issue. I've stated in the brief there are Blakely, Ameline issues in this particular case. There were four counts, found guilty of counts one and two. He was acquitted on three and four. And at sentencing, there was acquitted conduct and relevant conduct. The current status of the law in the Ninth Circuit with Ameline, we asked and suggested that supplemental briefing be done or that.
Well, the Supreme Court raises a question. We have some law that this is a fairly lengthy sentence, or isn't it?
Fairly lengthy sentence?
Lengthy. The question becomes, what do we do, whether we defer decision ourselves or whether we send it back? Under our law, we would some time ago have sent it back or have kept it. Do you have any antennae as to when the Supreme Court is going to come down?
I can put my resignation. Your Honor, I suggest I could put my resignation in today and make $1 million this afternoon, perhaps, if I knew. But I do not. I do not. I respect it. But the defendant with his 41-month sentence approximately has 2 years under his belt right now. Based upon his previous record in his criminal history Category 5, I doubt that he's going to – I assume that he's going to serve the majority of that. Would be my.
But if the sentence were – had to be reduced because of a Blakely error, he's not likely to serve beyond what would be constitutionally permissible based on what the jury did find.
I think the current status of the law and the way I calculated that, Your Honor, is that he would be – instead of a 14, he'd be a level 12 with criminal history category 5, I think it's 27 to 33 months would be the range.
And he's already served 24 months of that?
I can't tell you exactly how long he's – he was in approximately that, Your Honor. Once again, to reiterate that this is clearly a – all of the cases, including those that we've post-Crawford counsel submitted the Sixth Circuit case. I submitted two additional cases last Friday, the Parley, P-A-R-L-E case and the Levitt case, that the – clearly once the smoke clears, everybody is once again defining what's testimonial and not testimonial. And most recently, the Ninth Circuit has indicated in those particular cases the significance of what you look at for testimony, whether or not it's potentially before interrogation by police or knowing the circumstances under which it's going to be presented in the future. I believe that all of the evidence does not show that Crawford is applicable, that the tapes themselves were admitted properly, and that replete we were offering the informant's language on the tape. How do you offer it if you redact it? It makes no sense to it. It wasn't for the truth of the matter, but in the proper context in which these matters occurred, Your Honors. Thank you.
Thank you.
To answer the question, Stanley was arrested in July of 2002, shortly after his indictment. He was incarcerated pre-trial until his conviction in August. He was sentenced in the fall and remains incarcerated this time, which is something over 30 months.
So he's served 30 months already?
Yes, from 2002, 2003, 2004. That's 24 months in July, and here we are in January of 2005, so about 30 months. If this testimony is not testimonial, what else is it? The new cases cited by this circuit identify a written statement in a diary that is distinguishable clearly on the face. It recites an excited utterance by a victim. The distinguishing factors that the court found to determine those things trustworthy are the very factors that are absent here. You identified absence of contemplation of litigation. You identified absence of motive to fabricate. You identified a removal of the written documents as being a well-recognized exception to the hearsay. And in each case, we avoided an application of Crawford that might be retroactive. We're saying in this case we don't need a retroactive application of Crawford because the Crawford record was made below when we objected to the hearsay of the agent in anticipation of an entrapment defense, that had you been informed that some monies were owed to Mr. Stanley, objection, overruled. What was your understanding that money was for? Answer, it was purchase of drugs. Your Honor, object, overruled. Okay. It was for a previous purchase of drugs by the CS for Mr. Stanley. So in preparing him for the meet, did the meet occur? The point is that that is clearly testimony. And the transcripts of these undercover operations cannot be divorced. Cannot be divorced.
What was the citation for?
I was referring to transcript trial, page 51, where that exchange occurs. The expediency of suggesting that an admission against interest exception authorizes the use of testimonial nature of a CS simply isn't justifiable. The First Circuit has conducted that analysis and concluded by definition confidential informant testimony is testimonial. If you apply that rule and if this testimony of the CS and the characterizations and descriptions of what the CS told the investigating officers, which was in turn related to the jury, is testimonial, then there is a plain error rule. Confrontation clause has been violated and the reversal is not sustainable, or the conviction is not a sustainable reversible error. Thank you.
We got the point.
Gotcha. All right. Thank you. The case just argued is submitted for decision. Before hearing the next cases, the court will take a 10-minute recess.